This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, this week's podcast is brought to you by the Friends of the Magic Word. This week, we want to welcome Gary Weimer, who is the most recent person who has donated some financial support our way. So thank you very much, Gary, for your financial help and helping to keep this podcast going. We also thank all of the other donors who have helped over the past months and years, and even particularly during this time whenever that things are pretty tight, it makes it even all the more sweet. So I appreciate all of your financial support, and thank you, Gary, and welcome again. And speaking of which, we are now into our seventh week of the Magician's Relief Project, and we are now up to $116 a week that is going towards a magic shop, and then they in turn will give that amount of credit towards a magician who has been identified needing some relief. And so some names have been submitted, and if your name is not in the barrel yet, you can still have a chance to perhaps be one of the last selected in the last few weeks here. Just go to the website at themagicwordpodcast.com, and there's a form where you can fill out your name and email address, and you will remain anonymous. The only person who would know that would be myself, and then also the person who is the magic dealer who will be getting in contact with you to let you know how to redeem the funds. Speaking of which, I don't know how many of you might be aware of the CARES Act. That's C-A-R-E-S. I wanted to read something here that might be of particular interest to gig performers. It says, following the outbreak of the new coronavirus, or the COVID-19, that many across the country have found themselves out of work and having to file for unemployment. With over 20 million unemployment claims being filed, officials have begun to roll out unemployment benefits under the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, Economic Security Act, or CARES Act. The CARES Act is a new law that aims to provide fast and direct economic assistance to American workers and small businesses seeking to preserve jobs in all industries. The act was passed with overwhelming bipartisan support and signed into law in late March of this year. But this is where I think it gets kind of interesting. The two of the major revisions to the unemployment insurance system expanded benefits to those who would not traditionally qualify. An additional $600 per week was given to those affected by the pandemic in mid-April through two new stimulus programs, the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, or the PUA, and the Federal Pandemic Unemployment Compensation, or FPUC, program. The PUA program adds an additional 13 weeks' worth of benefits, while also extending the benefits to workers that are not traditionally eligible, such as those who are self-employed. The FPUC adds an additional $600 a week to unemployment claims. Okay, so who qualifies for unemployment under the benefits of the CARES Act? Anyone unemployed due to COVID-19 after January 27, 2020 is eligible to apply for CARES Act benefits. The Act expands eligibility to contract workers, those who are self-employed, and others not typically eligible for unemployment benefits. Independent contractors and self-employed workers that have already applied for unemployment benefits do not need to reapply for the PUA. The FPUC program will provide the additional $600 per week, as mentioned before. Those who qualify for at least a minimum amount of unemployment benefits will qualify for an additional $600 per week in the event COVID-19 caused or contributed to the unemployment, which would be our case, that a lot of our shows have been canceled and we're out of work, you know, basically. So that's why I'm saying it, we'll be applying to gig performers. So, just some information, if you are not already aware of that or you have not already applied for that, it might be something worth looking into, and I'm sure that you could do a little Google search for the CARES, the CARES Act, or the PUA, so this way that you can see if perhaps you might qualify for some unemployment benefits as a gig employee. Well, last week we talked with Mark D'Souza, and one of the things that he offered us was an opportunity to win some prizes. And we are continuing with that contest. And if you haven't yet filled out that form, if you'll go to this week's website at themagicwordpodcast.com, and you can fill out the form there, and a couple of names will be randomly selected. And within the next week or so, and perhaps this next week, we might be wrapping up the contest. We usually run these for about 2 weeks, and so we may be ending this next week. So hurry up, go and sign up for the contest. Now, let's get into our main event. As a policy, the Magic Word Podcast does not promote nor endorse products nor performers. That means that if you have a new trick on the market, a new digital download, DVD, or book of tricks, or something that you invented or manufacture, this podcast is not the platform for you to market that product. If you're about to open with a performance in a new venue, or perform a new show, or a special television appearance is coming up, this is not the platform for you to market your upcoming appearance. That being said, there are three exceptions. First is that in the context of our discussion on other topics, you happen to have something noteworthy to announce or promote, then I will allow a short announcement. It is the least I could do for those who freely give me their time by coming on this podcast. Secondly, I have taken time in previous podcasts to give an unabashed, candid, and personal review of magic tricks that have been sent to me by Murphy's Magic Supplies. Some have asked me why I haven't posted any reviews of late. I no longer regularly do those reviews because, well, quite frankly, I don't have the time that it takes to do all this on top of producing these weekly podcasts. I, first of all, have to read the trick, oftentimes actually constructing the tricks, practicing and performing the tricks, then coherently recording a summary review. I typically review these about three or four tricks a week, or when I was doing those, three or four. Each would take 2 or 3 hours to thoroughly prepare and perform, then record. If it was a DVD, then it would take even longer because usually the DVDs were 1 to 3 hours in length unless there were multiple set of DVDs. Then it'd take even longer. And after doing those reviews over a period of over a year, then posting them for sale on my online magic store, I sold less than $100 retail per year in 1 year. So that just is ridiculous. So it was really not worth my time. And it also took away from the intent of the podcast, which is to really be about conversations with conjurers, and I really want to keep my focus on that. The third exception, which is what this is all leading up to, is that I will gladly feature a magician who's talking about a product that's unique and perhaps breaks new ground, and in my opinion, could help our community to grow. I like to feature guests, even if I haven't met them or worked with them before or not been friends I have known for a long time. But if someone who has a fresh perspective and something new to offer, that's not a new trick. We all have and we all know enough tricks. We just need to know how to do them better. So in the spirit of my third exception, this week we present a conversation with Ryan Kane, author of Out of Stock, A Magician's Guide to Writing Your Own Lines. Not only is the content of what he has to say important, but also the cost of the book is incredibly low through Amazon. This week we chat with San Francisco magician Ryan Kane, who is a street performer who brings his skills to corporate audiences too. I found his approach unique and insightful, as he said he works on material over and over again on the street before he brings them into his refined corporate audiences. Moreover, I admire him for not only rewriting his script to edit out all the stock lines, but he does it every year and a half. In this discussion, Ryan gives us an outline of his book and suggests how we can identify and change the scripting in our own shows. I found his perspective both enlightening and educational. I hope you do too. So please welcome my guest this week, Mr. Ryan Kane, here on The Magic Word. Hello from Houston. This is Scott Wells, and also from San Francisco, all the way out in California. I've got somebody else who's going to say hello too. This is Ryan Kane. Hey, Ryan.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad that you are on. Yes, that I'm here. We're doing this over Skype, and the weather is just absolutely stellar, perfect, and it's good to have a chance to chat with you. So you're in San Francisco, actually in Sausalito, so you're just kind of out in the bay and got a nice view out there.
Yeah, Sausalito, which is just four exits north of Golden Gate Bridge. So if I stand out, I can see San Francisco from my house, and it's pretty close. It's very nice.
What is your drive time like? I mean, do you have like a job you go to from time to time? And...
No, I'm a full-time performer. So I do work in the city a lot. I work, Bay Area is very, very good for magic and corporate shows and things like that, because, you know, Google and the tech industry really like having things like magic at activity. So it's very, very good here. getting into the city, you know, if there's traffic, it could take an hour, but generally getting in, you can get in there like 20, 30 minutes. It's actually, I lived in Oakland for a year, and that bridge, which is actually a much shorter drive, would take way longer just because there's more people that go over the Bay Bridge than the Golden Gate Bridge.
Right. Yeah, I've been over there. My my best friend since we were in kindergarten, we were roommates even in college, and lives in Oakland, and he's an attorney, and he goes across back and forth from the Bay Bridge there too, so I'm familiar with what you're talking about.
The one advantage is you have BART over there, so you can take the subway in. So if I had like a walk around gig in like the Fight Eye or downtown, I would just jump on that and walk to the gig, because that would just be way faster than trying to drive in.
Right. Now, as far as the type of shows that you're doing, are you mainly doing close-up and corporate, or I mean, like cocktails and things? You don't do any birthday parties or anything for kids?
No. My background is street performing. I started street performing when I was like 14 in Old Sacramento. So I got to, and I knew pretty early on that I didn't want to do children's entertainment. So I didn't, I kind of got to skip the kids party part of like getting your first 1,000 shows in, because I could street perform and do that quickly. So I've done maybe 5 kid shows in my life. Mm-hmm. And in San Francisco, I could street perform when I was younger. I still perform at Pier 39, mostly as a way to try out new material. They have a stage out there.
Well, Pier 39 is, isn't that Fisherman's Wharf area kind of out there? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Pier 39 is essentially in a shopping mall. It's one of the largest tourist attractions in the city.
Yes.
Yeah, and they have a stage back there, and they have a program that's been there for forever. So I have a stage and lights and seats and everything.
Do you have
like
to get a permit to work and everything?
It has an audition process, so there's a program that I'm a part of. There's also, you can street perform on the wharf, Fisherman's Wharf there, and there's a program for that I've never been a part of. I did that years ago when I was like still in college, leaving college. And it was before, it's transformed because they made a new promenade that has a lot more space. And so now you have big juggling acts and big shows that can be there. When I used to street perform there, there was one spot where you could do like a circle show, breakdancing show. And then everything else was like balloon twisters and like and statues and stuff. And I would work between them and just do a small doorway act of like a, you know, 13-minute show. I'd get out there before anyone else got there, and I'd work, do like 2 hours. And then as soon as anyone else showed up, I just leave, because I made what I had to do. And it was a much smaller thing. I haven't worked the promenade because I'm not a busker anymore. I perform at Pier 39. Really just to try out new material. Like that is, it's always, as soon as the show gets too good, I just break it and I move things around and like do all sorts of different things. So so my street show is not good because I think you need to find a place where you can try out new material in a very, very safe manner. Mm-hmm. And streets are really good for that. Any situation where the audience can walk away is fantastic. Mm-hmm.
Because you get your immediate feedback.
Yeah. And then at the end you have a hat that's like, here's another barometer of like, oh, that made more money than that show. You know, why? Well, maybe I was nicer that show, or maybe I was a little bit more on top of it, or a million different things that can lead into that. So that's what I really use for. And then for the other things, yeah, I do comedy parties, corporate shows in the area. More recently, I got into trade shows, which again, you know, cycles back to street performing. Mm-hmm. Really good at gathering a crowd and bringing people in. And also, I've gotten more into like writing. So like I can take boring things and make them funny or interesting. Mm-hmm. And that's really good for trade shows too, of like, yeah, you know, this is a hard drive or a whatever, and I can make it more interesting than just talking.
I don't know if people really recognize the similarities that there are between street performing and trade shows. But if you boil it down, you're trying to tip a crowd. You're trying to get a group to come around you and pay attention to listen to what you're trying to say or sell. In the case of street performing, you're trying to get people to put money in your hat. In the case of the trade show, you're trying to get that same group to actually come into the booth, cross over that invisible line, talk to the salespeople and buy something or become a new customer or something. So you're trying to engage them long enough and keep them interested enough to actually want more information. Do you find whenever that you are on the street sometimes that people then will make that connection? I mean, are there corporate clients who said, hey, this guy is really good. Have you ever thought about coming and doing our show over here for Apple or something?
Not anymore. I mean, when I was younger and it was like, oh, this guy has potential. Like, you know, it's like when he's like 18, it's like, oh, this guy could do whatever. Now it's, I don't think that people jump that. People tend to see you in whatever venue they see you. So like people will hire, will see me at Pier 39, which looks very much like a festival. And again, there with the rafters and everything, there's like 400 people that can be watching the show at one time if it's completely full. So, you know, and it is a stage, but nobody's looking at that saying, ah, you know what, I want him for my corporate event, because it's, the setting is so different. So that's why I don't really advertise like to my clients or anything that I'm really at Pier 39.
Right.
It's just I'm there. And because it, again, it just gives me an opportunity to make some money, but mostly just to try out new stuff.
You know, that's a big problem I think that most magicians have, is that you don't have a place to be bad or a place to try out something. You know, the two things you cannot rehearse is timing and misdirection. You know, you can't misdirect yourself. And as far as the timing, you know, you have to have an audience, at least one other person to kind of interact with in order to grow and to work on some material. And certainly that, I think the street would be the easiest place that you could go out and try and get a crowd, even if you get some one person to kind of walk by and watch a little bit, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it is and it isn't. The problem with the street is you are always playing to the lowest common denominator, and there's certain things that you
can't quite do there.
People can't invest as much time. You can't really do a lot of subtlety and stuff. Like certain, like mentalism is really hard to do on the street. Before this happened, I put together like a new finale for my show, which was essentially a giant open prediction where at the top of the show, I'd come out and say, look, by the end of the show, you guys will see something levitate. You know, you guys will be shouting in German, all this. And I'd list all these like impossible things that, and then at the end, all of these things would happen. It's a great thing for like a show, but it's a terrible idea for a street show, because then you get to the end and all this stuff would happen. And like some people would be laughing and other people like, what is going on? You're like, so you can't. But I knew that going in, that the only reason I'm doing this at Pier 39 is because I want to rehearse it. I want to see how this works for those, you know, 10-15% that were there for the top, just so that then I, and as soon as it got good, I took it out of the show and put it in my my theater show. And then I just put in the next thing to work on at the pier. And that's what I'm constantly doing, is I'm just moving things around. As soon as it starts getting good, I break it. I have a good friend named Thomas, Thomas German John, who's a fantastic juggler and comedian. And he used to perform at Pier 39. He actually left like the month that I got on there. So we've always kind of been ships passing in the night, of like, we're good friends, but like we barely ever spend time together. Like we work Santa Cruz Boardwalk once a year and we hang out for a week and that's it. But his big thing is like, look, if you're going to go do Pier 39, you should either try to make as much money as possible, or you shouldn't care at all. And your show should just be like completely new ideas, because it doesn't matter. And ultimately you will make kind of the similar amount. Like if you do a kind of okay show versus a show that's like very new and fresh, ultimately, if you're having fun and like there's some polish and the tricks work, you'll probably make the same. It's when you really hyper polish it up and like really pay attention to, like, you know, street shows are very, very delicate in exactly what you're talking about. Getting people in, sustaining them, and then convincing them to pay you. And if you tweak anything like that, you will lose money. But if you're like me and just like, I'm okay with losing money per show because I'm developing new material, that's great. And so I've always been very, very fortunate that I have that opportunity, like that venue. Not a lot of people have it. Finding a place to perform is important, and you can get creative, right? Like my good friend David Gerard is a mentalist, and a lot of mentalists don't do walk around, but he does. And a big part of that is because he can then try ideas for his mentalism show in walk around. So he'll do stuff that he's planning for the stage and just pare it down to like a tiny close-up trick. And so then it's like, why is he so good at revealing a name that someone's thinking of? It's because he's not getting on stage once or twice a week and doing that trick. He's doing it, you know, 14, 15 times in one evening, multiple times a week.
Right.
Right. So you can get creative there.
Well, another thing, I think whenever that, you know, Cosmo had said that if you are just doing a long trick, that some people who are coming in late didn't catch the first part of that and they don't know kind of what's going on, they lose interest and walk on. And others really don't want to spend the time to be invested in this longer effect that you're trying to do. And so that's why it should be a series of kind of quick things. You can't have something at the end that might tie everything together for those people who may have been hanging around still to recap what kind of had happened. People might just, who were there late, might just catch the last two or three things, but the ones who were there earlier. But the point is, I think that if you kind of, you know, keep it quick, paced and comical, and that you get a chance then to work on that kind of new material that you can flesh out more, you know, when you do actually get on stage then with a bigger paying audience. But I understand also what you're talking about as far as trying to keep an audience on the street, and it's difficult. I'll tell you, another place is a shopping mall. I remember working in shopping malls in some of my earlier years, and basically you're a babysitter. You know, in the case of a street magician, I don't suppose very often that you have parents who will say to their kids, honey, stay here, watch a magician, we're going to go shopping, you know, because they're not going to leave them on the street, I wouldn't think. In a shopping mall, completely different. It's like leaving him with the neighbors almost. It's kind of like, hey, I can see you. I'm going to be at the shop just right over here. I'm going to be watching or whatever. And, you know, you end up being a babysitter. Have you ever had any issues like that? You know, kind of feel like you're babysittering?
Well, yeah, at Pier 39, definitely, because Pier 39 is a shopping mall, right?
That's true, like, outdoor shopping
mall. I'm on a stage, and, like, there's a carousel behind me, and there's all sorts of things. I joke about it. You know, I have jokes for if people leave their kids and stuff. Because, again, I'm not a kid performer. I use kids. I work clean. But, like,
sure,
it's not, like, the worst thing is actually at the pier when you get school groups where there's, like, you know.
I mean, they bus kids in?
Yeah, you know, so they'll be, you know, and it's great, but then they're always there for the early shows, and then they'll sit and take up all the space. And the problem with that is there's three issues. One is there's usually like one or two chaperones for like, you know, a dozen kids, and that's not their parents, so they're not going to listen to them. Two is like those kids don't have money, so like they're not going to make any money for me, right? And the chaperones usually aren't paid a lot, so like they generally will not tip enough.
Right.
And then the third thing that affects me more than other people is like anybody walking around and looks at me, the first thing they see is like, oh, there's a dude and a bunch of kids. This is for kids.
Yes.
And that's not my show.
Gotcha.
And my show's really like, a kid will like my show, but if it's all kids, my show's not good for them. Like, it's a really, really bad show. It's not
Do you
funny.
Tighten up the show then and make it a shorter show when if you see there are a lot of kids and say, okay, well, we'll come back later or what? Are you giving the same normal show?
What it is, I generally do the same show, and I literally add in things about they're not like this isn't a kid show, like to people. Once I get some adults sitting down, I usually also talk to the chaperone and like I ask like, do you have a bus to catch? What's going to happen? I give them a layout of like what the show is about to be, because sometimes like, you know, they'll sit there, but they gotta, you know, the show's supposed to be 30 minutes and they'll sit for 20 minutes and then we gotta go. And then my whole audience just gets up and leaves right as you're getting the hat pitch. And it's just like, well, that was stupid.
Waste of time.
Yeah. So it's like, and usually if you talk to them, they'll usually be pretty chill. And I'll let them know, like, look, that you guys are totally welcome to watch, but like, this is not really a kid show. So, you know, whatever. And, you know, I used to do, I do a paintball bullet catch, which I used to do at the pier for a long time. Wouldn't do it anymore, but I used to put up a sign that said magic show rated PG-13, and that I discovered was bug repellent for school kids, because I think the teachers think that it literally is rated PG-13, so they have to have like a rider signed for their kids, so they would see that and just leave. So I discovered that having that up would avoid school groups.
Well, couldn't you still leave that sign up even though you're not doing the paintball thing?
I probably could, but the reason was because like, okay, there's gonna be like a paintball gun in this and whatever. And people sometimes ask, what does that mean? I don't think the pier ever really knew about it. I don't think they'd probably like it because they want it to be Disney.
Yeah, exactly.
But I got away with it for 4 years or something like that.
Well, I have a friend who was using a thing in which it was just basically his hand, like a handgun. You know, he'd, you know, say, okay, we're both carrying these guns, and, you know, whip it out, and you know, I want you to say bang or something. And, and he was doing that in the context, I want to say it might have been a school show or something where there were a lot of children, but he really caught a lot of heat. I mean, that was like, he never did that again.
Yeah.
Because that even with it's a handgun, you don't want to have anything that's going to raise a flag for kids.
Like yeah, that. I still do paintball bullet catch. I mean, I wouldn't do it for like a grad night or an audience of all kids or anything like that. But and it used to be the finale of my like theater show and stuff. It no longer is, because if it's the finale and you're building up to the whole time, now it becomes the gun show. Now I actually do it like it's the second trick I do, like is the bullet catch. And then it's like
kind of get it out of the way.
Yeah, because then it's, you know, it and it's also the what is it? What's the guy's name? Is going to come back to me. The idea of like, how do you build a new act? I try to write a new show every year and a half. is, you know, you take whatever you closed with and now you open with it and then you build there. Mm-hmm. That I think is a strong thing. So it's like, yeah, you just take the bullet catch and move it to the front and it's good. And now you have to find somewhere else to go with it. And I call it paintball bullet catch more. I used to just call it bullet catch. And now it's like I say paintball a little bit more throughout the trick.
I've seen other people who have actually gone a little bit further in which they would be doing just a squirt gun kind of a thing. You know, mm-hmm. That they would using that as well. You mentioned David Girard a little bit earlier. I have a friend, a magician, David Girard, in Louisville, Kentucky. I don't think it's probably the same guy you're thinking of, though.
No, David Girard's a fantastic mentalist, and he's local San Francisco as well.
Okay. Yeah, the one I was thinking of actually had worked. He's been on Penn and Teller Fool Us, and was a friend of, you know, grew up with Matt Cain, Lance Burton there in mm-hmm. the Louisville area, and has got just a great show. And he does very little mentalism, mainly just stage stuff and everything, and too, he's got a great lecture. But yeah, doing mentalism, going back to that for just a minute, and doing a little bit of walk around then as well. You say you do a little bit of mentalism then in your show as well, but not so much on the street as it is then later in your full stage act?
Well, I have weird opinions on mentalism. I don't think that mentalism is like a thing. Like if you decide, look, I'm only going to do divinations and psychokinetic things, or everything's gonna be tied to your mind, sure, right. You're a mentalist, right? And you're presenting a mentalism show. But I do tossed out deck, and I would do that on the street. That was my crowd gather for a long time. I don't view that as a mentalism trick. That's just a magic trick. Like, I'm just passing out cards, I'm bringing people up, and then I'm telling, and like, I'm reading their minds and doing that. That's just impossible. So I don't really view, there are things that you could look at me like, oh, that's a mentalism trick, but I would like, it's just a magic trick. Like, that's all it is to me, because I don't want to ever transition into like that. I think this is a very generic thing that magicians do, is they get to that part where it's like, okay, now we're going to do mentalism, and their entire character changes because now they feel
true.
And it's like, and that's what I try to, they do with comedy too, where it's like, oh, they'll do a pretty, you know, sincere, genuine show, and then they'll do ketchup bottle, and suddenly now they're this clown buffoon. And it's like, what are you doing? Like, you should be more consistent. And so, yeah, I mean, I do toss out deck. I do some other prediction stuff. I do a book test. I really don't do that much in walk around outside of some card effects where I will tell people what they're thinking of in some predictions.
Invisible deck or something even?
No, just like mem deck stuff of telling people what cards that, but again, it's never presented as like a mind reading thing. Like, my character is very much like I'm a magician, I'm accomplished, I'm good, and like I use theater, and it's not quite as like Penn and Teller, like, oh look, we're using tricks. I'm not that out there, but like I'm just a really good magician, and I can learn to do some stuff. And like the line I tell people if they are like, oh my God, I'm so frustrated, is like, look, I just have a head start. I've been thinking about these moments for, you know, years and years. You just started the race. That's why I can fool you. That's what's going on. Mm-hmm. I try to get away from thinking of things in like mentalism, just because I think that's not a good way to look at it.
Well, you got to touch on something I think was kind of interesting as well, that has to do with the, continuity of a show. I will never forget an early show that I saw when I was getting involved in magic in the 1970s, and there was a fellow doing a stage act, and he was doing a very heavy, kind of very serious type of a show, and he, I remember, had a zombie using a skull, you know, a skeleton head, and I don't know what else, and he was doing some very serious mentalism with no humor or whatever. He even had a floating piano, you know, he did all this and had some ominous music and everything, and probably did about, I don't know, 30 minutes of all this, and you kind of start to believe this guy has these, quote, powers, you know, of being able to do what he can do. And then he did a head chopper, had somebody come up, and then it was, oh, the music changed, his demeanor changed, his lines changed, and it's like doo 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 doo, and he was kind of a goofy guy. It's like, that just didn't make sense to me at all. It remind me of just a little bit later that David Copperfield had done something on his TV special, and he did something that I think he later regretted, which was Let's Burn a Deal, and he was using Terry Seabrook's burn bill and wallet routine. Mm-hmm. And the way way that he had done this, that he had all these funny lines, and for him to say the kinds of lines he was saying, it didn't sound like him. It sounded like they were scripted for him, and he was kind of reading them and then trying to go, you know, laughing as if that they were funny also, when he wasn't really, he wasn't invested in that kind of a thing. And it was completely different than the rest of the character he had developed during part of the show. And then suddenly during this segment, it's like, what the heck was that? You know, if you go back and look at it, at least that's my opinion, you know?
Yeah. I think that's the risk you run when you start piecemealing shows together, and it starts with lines. And then also, I mean, when, if you're going to go from a trick from one person's type of act to another trick from another performer's act, and you just put them in and plug them into your show, an essay that never made it into the book, cause I never got it quite down, was the talking about, like, I think magicians paint vertically, where it's just like a stripe of, like, here's my comedy trick. Okay, great. That's all here in one column. And then you get to, like, here's my here's my origin trick, where I talk about where I am and I'm sentimental about whatever. Mm-hmm. And then here's my mentalism trick. Now I can read minds, right? And it's very bad. And, like, what I want to do is do it point horizontally, where that goes throughout the show. Like, if your character either makes jokes and is a clown, or they're not. And that needs to be consistent throughout. Mm-hmm. Right. So take your jokes, spread them out. Your character can either read minds or they cannot. Decide that, and then make sure that that's consistent throughout the entire piece. Paint a landscape as opposed to, like, fence posts. And a thing I do a lot with the book is more about lines. So I cut out a lot of things about like structure and stuff like that. But
before,
like,
we go there, hold on, let me get into that, just to introduce this then as well, because I hadn't mentioned there before that you do have a new book that's out. That's called Out of Stock.
I have a book called Out of Stock, A Magician's Guide to Writing Your Own Lines. And it's designed for the working performer who has a repertoire but wants to go through, identify, interpret, and replace stock lines and stolen material. And it goes through, it shows step by step, just like, here's how we're going to find them in your show, here's how to figure out what these jokes are about and how to rewrite them.
So these are things that you have actually researched and found from your own work and performing on the streets and other shows, and then seeing other performers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So my background is, again, I was a street performer, and, like, I was a Gazzo clone, you know. I was doing his act. I had, you know, a lot of, like, Gregory Wilson lines, a lot of Jay Sankey lines, and just other things that were, like, in my show.
Yeah.
And it was like, I was working and it was good. It was a good show, but I always felt really bad about it. And so, you know, because it's like, this isn't mine, right? Like, I already have that relationship with magic where you do something really cool and be like, oh, my God, this is so, you know, impactful and stuff. And I'm just, it's a lie, right? And I wanted to be more truthful, especially when it was like, man, you're so funny. I'm like, but these aren't my lines. I just stole these. These are the things. So I got really serious a couple years ago about going through and getting rid of stock lines. And so I started reading more about comedy writing and things like that. And I went through and deleted stuff and just replaced them. And so this is really my method that I applied to my own show, and I got rid of dozens and dozens of stock lines and really set a new standard for myself.
What kind of books did you recommend? What kind of books do you recommend as far as a comedy writing?
Comedy writing. So what really started, Greg Dean's book, Step by Step to Stand-Up Comedy, is really good. My buddy Scott Meltzer also has some fantastic columns on his website, which is comedyindustries.com/columns. Lately I've actually been reading The Comedy Bible by Judy Carter, which is also fantastic.
It's an old book, but it's been around for a while. That's a good one.
It's very good. Yeah.
I've read that.
That gets into a lot more of like the specifics of, like, joke writing and things like that, and being, especially Carter's, like, very, like, be true to yourself. Those books exist. What didn't exist was a book that really focused on just magic and applying this type of writing technique to one specific problem. And that's what this is. And it ties into, again, something that I've done of really going from, like, very, very hacky act to, and still, I'm not, like, the most original performer out there. My show isn't nuts pushing that. I'm not Rob Zabrecki, like, weird thing. Like, but it's my jokes. Like, they are very true to me. I wrote pretty much everything, and there's some really good stuff in there. And,
like, what kind of stock lines were you talking about that you got rid of?
Oh, yeah. Like, so, like, you know, you, sir, if in fact that is your real name, right? Like, I would do that all the time. I would do the, a lot of street lines for like when people coming late. So it's like, oh yeah, sit right, you know, take a kid here, sit right here. This is your new family, right? Where are you going? I didn't walk away when you got here, right? Jokes for when things fall. A big part of why I think stock lines come into people's acts is that they're all functional, right? They deal with situations, with props, with characters, which magicians are constantly dealing with, right? That's why everyone's having someone pick a card. Okay, not that one, right? That's such an easy thing to add it that you know you're going to add,
right?
You know, get that laugh. The permanent marker, oh, it rubbed off, right? You say permanent, but now it rubbed off. We're all introducing Sharpie markers. That's why they get stuck. So the book is about going through, and there's like five steps that it runs through. The first is like, listen to your act, write down every stock line that you say, right? No matter what, every single one. Also write down what happened before it. And then you're going to go
through.
You
mean the trick, or mean the action that happened, or what was
the line?
The line, okay, that led into that.
The lead in, especially for like cover lines, right? Like if it is, if you're saying the line, you know, like, hey, you know, you do a moment, it's something in your show, a magic trick or joke, and like one person claps, and you tell that person, like, hey, you know, if you run around, it sounds like everyone's clapping, right?
Right, right.
You should write down what is that moment that didn't get the applause that you wanted, right? Like, write down the exact phase, write down the exact joke that you had a cover line for, because later on, do you need that joke? Can you make that better? Those are important things to recognize. And then once you figure out, once you have all of them, all of the stock lines and stolen lines too, right? Like it's any joke in your show that you know you didn't write. That's what you should be writing down.
But probably most of the lines in most magicians' shows are not your own lines. They're things that are amalgams of everyone else that you have seen or heard or
you know,
taken from their acts or from the little trick, or even whenever that you buy a trick, it comes with the lines then as well. I mean, that like here's the presentation, not just here's how you do it, but here's how you present it also and the lines that you say with that.
Yep.
And so that gets stuck into your mind then as well.
Right. It's the culture of magic. They're everywhere,
good
right?
Point.
Like they're in FISM, they're in our conferences, they're in our books, our patter lines, they're on shows. I mean, David Copperfield uses them, and there's no mechanism. Nobody's pressuring you to get rid of them. Like no magician's going to tell you to get rid of them.
Your unless it's their own line. I mean, that sometimes people will feel like that's a proprietary thing of mine.
That's
and it's
a good
like,
point.
I remember Matt King saying something once to somebody saying, "You're stealing my babies." You know,
yeah.
These are my lines.
Yeah. But those are like, but your peer's not going to do it, right? Like if I come to
comedians are much more sensitive to this than magicians are, I think. You know,
they had a renaissance, right? So we're running on magic still runs on the vaudevillian ethics of like
what do you
look,
mean?
you can borrow something back in like vaudeville when like, you know, you were traveling around and it was such a tough thing. It's very much similar to how street performers are much more forgiving of stealing each other's lines because it's so tough. And so the idea was like, look, we're probably never going to be performing in the same venue for the same audience ever. So if you like a bit, as long as you kind of like make it your own or whatever, that's fine because we're never going to be in the same spot. Right.
Right.
That's kind of how magicians work. Oh, it doesn't matter. I changed the punchline. So it's new. It's like, it's not really not comedy. Stand up comedy had the Catskills and it had other mechanisms where now everyone was going and working in the same area. And now they were performing to the same audiences. And that's where they had to develop it. Like, look, we cannot still just be doing the same hack lines. We need to make sure and police ourselves. And there's massive problems still in the stand-up comedy world. But I think that's where they got much more instilled of like, you need to be writing your own material. And the comedy, the other thing too, is
they
like,
tend to police themselves. I believe though, also, you know, if you hear someone else who is using your line, you know, it gets back to that person pretty quickly. It's like, hey dude, that's not your line. You're using someone else's joke here.
There's a mechanism for that too, though. Right. Because if you're going to do stand up comedy, you're rising up the ranks of open mic to
right.
opener to
right.
thing. Right. And
right.
so there's, you're surrounded by people that have that standard. And if you show up to that first open mic and do somebody else's show, they're not going to be invited back. Right. Magic doesn't have that. We go straight from learning magic to getting booked. And then nobody tells you, like magicians get paid way too early. And we get paid way too much, way too early. There's a novelty to it.
You buy a trick today and you get your cards made tomorrow, you know?
Yeah. You know, and so
your business cards,
there's no mechanism. So, and I'm not here, like, look, if you're listening to this saying I do stock lines, I don't see a problem. Fine. Like, great. We can disagree, but I think most people, most magicians, because it's every book and everyone's like, oh, I'm, you know, don't do stock lines. But there's no book that tells you what to do. And so this is the way to get rid of them from a functional standpoint of like, I don't want to transform anybody's show. But if you want to get rid of the stock lines, this is how I did it. and it works. And I've had people do this now. We're kind of at step two now of like, step one is identifying, writing it down, right? And again, and sometimes it's going to be, sometimes these will be lines that you say all the time. Other times there'll be things you say in response to people, right? Exactly like you said of, oh, that joke doesn't work. Step two is looking at the line and figuring out what the context of the line is. Why did I add this line to my show? What does it accomplish? What is it about? Why am I saying this, right? Very often it'll be something like, for example, the context of stand right here over the trap door.
Right.
Is I need to position an audience member on stage. That's a boring thing to do. That's what that joke is covering. That's why I added it, because I have to do this. I have to tell someone to stand here. But and it's funnier to say a line and get a laugh rather than just say, hey, can you stand here? Right. That's why they get added.
There's
all sorts of them. In the book, I list like 9 of them. Right. Like of just going through different rides, like write your name on the card and your phone number. Right. That writing your name on the card is an important thing, but it's boring. This makes it more interesting.
Yeah,
right.
Your social security number or something. Yeah. Your pen.
Pick your thing. Right. And they all have that. And so, you know, the other thing, too, is on context. I've had a couple people zoom too far in on the context. So, example, like the hold out your hand, know the clean one. Right. The context of that is having them hold out your hand. I have to have that happen. It's not a joke about hygiene. Right. It's not a joke about them making a mistake. It's mm-hmm. it's very, you got to zoom out and just be like, what is the general thing that this joke accomplishes? Once you do that, then you can move on to step three. Once you have all the context for all your thing, which is interpreting whether or not the line is something that's part of your base script or reactionary. So that comes back to what you were saying. Do I say this line every show, or do I only say this when something else happens?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Do I only say this when I get heckled? Do I only say this when a helicopter flies up overhead? And those are the things that you want to be prepared for, and you will want to rewrite. But first, I think you want to get rid of those baselines, which is most of them, I think, is actually, you know, sign the card, write your serial number.
Right, where they're actually – where you're – they're descriptive types of things. As you said, stand mm-hmm. here, hold this, do this, right? Where you're giving them instructions basically.
That are going to happen every show. Right?
Every show.
And also other things, right?
Okay.
Like,
gotcha.
So you know – if you like the show, I'm Ryan Kane. If you didn't like the show, I'm David Copperfield, right?
Yeah, right?
That's how you're ending your show.
Right.
And you're going to say that every show, so you want to replace those. Those are the first thing. And then the fourth way, and then the fourth step is replacing it, which is you take the context and you write a new joke for that. Now, writing a joke is really hard, but I don't know of anyone that can sit down and just write out a funny joke. One, but everyone can brute force. Everyone listening to this can brute force out funny ideas. And there's a very simple way of doing it, and that is you write down 10 attempts at it. You just write down 10 funny ideas. And the only rules are the ideas have to be original to you. You can't steal anything from a meme or a Twitter or a TV show or anything like that. And everything goes on the page, right? And then what happens is once you've written down 10 attempts at jokes, 10 attempts, and the joke you're writing again is for that context, right? So if we're rewriting the line, My name is Ryan Kane. Or if you like the show, I'm Ryan Kane. If you didn't, I'm David Copperfield or whatever.
Right.
The context of that is I need a joke to end my show on, and I want to reiterate my name so people remember me. That's what I'm writing. So write 10 jokes about how – 10 jokes to end your show and say your name. That's all you're writing, and you write 10 of them down. Most of these will be bad. I write them all the time. Most of them are bad.
It's part of brainstorming. You know, you need to brainstorm with yourself, basically.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing. After you write that down, one of them will be the funniest. Relative to the other 9, one will always be the funniest, and it will be yours. And that's the premise. If you've been stealing people's jokes your entire career, you probably have a good sense of what's funny. And you've probably written a couple jokes in your life, right? It's about presenting you now with new options to then choose from. And so once you have 10 ideas, you'll be able to look at actually that one's the funniest one. And that's what happens. And it doesn't matter that the other 9 sucked or weren't that great. And sometimes a couple of them can be good. And that's the basic process. If you sit down, you write 10 ideas, you pick the best one, and then you polish it up. And I give tips on that of like, how do we shorten it? How do we explore other punchlines? How would you make it longer? Can you make it topical and things like that?
Mm-hmm.
But that basic idea, and then that you can extrapolate to use to anything, right? So I use that same process, just writing 10 ideas and picking the one that seemed the best to figure out what to write this book about, right? I do that to develop themes for my show. It's just a writing process, which is simple. But it always works because creativity is always relative. It's just whatever is relative to that to the other options on the page, and that's how you can pick things and learn what to go forward with.
I remember some years ago in talking with Pat Hazel, who is a brilliant comedy writer and wrote for Seinfeld and himself and other kinds of things as well. And I remember him telling me, and I've told the story many times for people who listen to the podcast, in which that he had said that he was the person that Seinfeld would come to when the show wasn't working and the script needed some punching up a little bit because they have a live audience and they're just not hitting the way that it was. And so they bring it to him and say, hey, we need you to punch us up a little bit. And I said, that's got to be the greatest job in the world. And he said, nope, it's the worst job. You stop and think about it, because you got to write a line and you keep writing these lines and you think, okay, these are the ones that the script writers probably already thought of in the writer's room. And I've got to not just be funnier than the funniest person who is the script writer, but I've got to be funnier than the synergistic group together would be funny. So in other words, like you're talking about writing, you know, 10 lines, most of them are not going to be funny. And so I would go just a step further and say, once you got that, then you've got into the zone where you're thinking about that, toss those and think about something that's even funnier and go beyond that.
Sure. You know? Yeah. Well, I think it does narrow it down to, you will weed out a lot of the obvious jokes. And you can, like, one of the first things you do is get rid of obvious jokes from whatever people are like. Right now, everyone is making jokes about masks and social distancing. So any joke I write on that, I want to chuck because everyone's doing that. You shouldn't be making any joke that your audience can think up themselves generally.
But why wouldn't you want to have something that's going to be topical?
Topical's great, but if it's that like that's overplayed now, right?
Okay.
Like there are jokes that you can make and about
current situations or whatever's happening, whether there happen to be an earthquake.
It needs to be more than, oh, he said social distancing as a punchline. Right? Like if you look at some of the better what did I just do? I made a toilet paper joke the other day to a friend that I think was actually good. And it was on Twitter. He was talking about like, I'm done with this. I'm making chili. I'm going to make chili. And I replied like, wow, the world is in a toilet paper shortage and this man decides to make chili.
That's right? Funny.
Yeah. Which is a funny, but it's very like, it was very, very, very specific. And he responded like, that's the first toilet paper joke I've laughed at. And it's not because like it's just like showing that restraint of that. In the book, I talk a lot more about, especially in the what I just went over right there is just part one, and part two is about reacting on stage, and part three is about writing your own stuff. So there's a ton more there. And I talk about like, how can you avoid generic jokes and obvious jokes, like joking about people's names, right? Like it's so easy when you meet someone named Luke to make a Star Wars joke, right?
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, but Luke's heard these jokes, so he's not going to like them. Right. And most
like
people
had a person once named Mark. And I said, oh, it sounded like a dog with a lisp. I said that to somebody. And this guy had said, yeah, it's not the first time I've heard that. And just kind of stared at me. It's like, boy,
you know,
I shouldn't have said that.
It's like you want to start thinking. And again, when a lot of obvious, I mean, people say stock lines to me when I go here, pick a card. People are like, okay, not that. I'll have someone else saying, okay, not that one, while another person's picking the card. Right.
Funny.
I don't know. I don't think it's because they've heard the line before. I think it's just an obvious joke.
Mm-hmm.
And so that,
well,
that's
like, can you make my wife disappear? They think that's the first time that a magician's heard that.
Funniest thing in the world. They think it's so clever.
And they just laugh and laugh.
Yeah, you know, like right now I'm getting a million things about like out of stock, like what, you know, I thought it was out of stock for the book title, and it's just like, yeah, it's a obvious, well done guys, like, you know. It's always try to avoid that. But again, when you can do this ahead of time and write down that, you'll be able to see that's obvious, that isn't. And then it does come back to your part of like whatever that funniest idea on that page is. Now you can start exploring that, because it's like, okay, that idea probably ticks the boxes of having some comedy potential, being different enough and being unique to me. Right. Because I wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can start polishing it up and exploring alternate punchlines and really trying to make it into a bit. And then
that's the fourth part.
And the fifth part is putting it out there and starting the feedback loop, which ties back to the beginning of our conversation of like finding a place where you can try out new material safely, recording your shows, listening to it. Right. Like that's so important, because then you try the joke out, see if it gets a laugh, try different punchlines every show. And just listen and see like, okay, cool. This, you know, when I say this, this works. If I add this tag, it doesn't work. Tag, it means follow-up joke. You know, that, and then you're a writer. Now you're a comedian, because you're listening, recording.
Would you try these jokes on someone close to you, a loved one, or not?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I try things on especially like weird ideas that I don't know if it's quite going to connect. I try those on my girlfriend a lot. I try Twitter sometimes. Mm-hmm. I'll try things out there and see how many likes or feedback I'll get on that. But generally, like, you know, before this happened, like, I was performing pretty regularly. So I could try these in safe environments. And I would try, you know, you can throw in a couple at more important gigs. Walk around is a great spot because you get really quick feedback and it's so much more conversational.
Do it over and over. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, I can run them by friends too. If I'm really struggling with a joke, I'll be like, which of these is the best? You know, but it's just, most of it just comes down to performing real people.
So again, that's the fifth part of this. And you're saying that the book is divided like into three sections. And the second one was what, developing your act?
Yeah. So the first part is the script, dealing with the base script of like, let's get all of the stock lines out of your base script and replace them with new lines, new jokes. Mm-hmm. Part two is about the stage, which talks about those reactionary lines of how do you respond to things. And here I start pressuring people away from always writing a joke, because the way to respond to somebody isn't always a joke. There's other ways of doing it. So now we move from writing a joke to what I call a line, which is like a pathway or a line of thinking in response to something. So, and I provide 70 different, I think it's over 70 different like prompts for like things you should be prepared for, like when somebody comes late, or like when somebody gets on stage and they don't have reading glasses, or like when you misgender somebody. Like, you should have a plan for each of these situations, because if you don't, you'll be tempted to fill that space with a stock line or make a generic joke. The more prepared you can be, like, I am not on stage, I appear to be very quick and mm-hmm. funny and on. I'm really not that good at thinking on my feet. I'm really not good at improv, but I do have a lot of lines. And this is why, like, I fell into the stock line category really early, was like, I could weed things together and have a lot of stuff to be able to react to things, but they were all stock lines. What I did is I replaced all those with like original lines, so now it seems like, wow, this guy's really funny and with it. I'm really not. I just wrote all this stuff and tried it, and so I know what I'm doing, and so I can do that. And then again, now if I'm in the moment and something happens and I do think of an ad lib, I do think of like, oh, that's a funny joke, I probably already have another joke that I would normally say in that response. And I can actually judge this new spontaneous thought against my prepared material mm-hmm. to determine if that's worth trying. It might be worth trying. It might not be.
Well, magicians don't like to have quiet time or dead time. You don't want to have anything on stage in which you feel like that it's just, there's a process. You know, you're trying to fill the space during that process of going even across the stage to pick up a prop or something, that there needs to be a nice segue when you're doing one thing and going from one thing to the next, whether it's going from one trick to the next, or whether that during the context of a trick that you are asking someone to do certain things, and that we don't like to have that dead time where there's not some reaction of some sort or another, where people are oohing or eyeing, or more importantly, mm-hmm. perhaps laughing or applauding. And so we want to have those moments that will cause that. And that's why I think a lot of magicians, probably comedians as well, will count the LPMs, you know, how many laughs per minute do you get, you know?
Oh, David Gerard did a great, he did a lecture several years ago where he like looked at, I think, Aziz Ansari, Darren Brown, his own show, and like one other main comedian, and he counted the, I think he made it moments, but a laugh was a moment per minute of their first 10 minutes, to compare himself, to be like, this is the standard, guys. Like, how many laughs are you getting in your, and it was really mind blowing. Coming back to that. Yeah. The book is, it has writing prompts, and it tells you to kind of like sit down and write, and tells you what to do. Between each of those, I actually have other essays that talk about other performance techniques and or performance ideas and tips and ways to do it, to avoid generic material. And it comes back to what you said right there, of like, one of the essays is very much about how do you make the procedure of your show interesting, because when you think about it, most of your magic show is not actually magic, right? Like, Build a Lemon, the only real moments of magic are like maybe the bill appearing in, like, that first revelation of it being inside the lemon, and then the unfolding and the signature matches,
right?
Everything else is barring the bill, having it signed, having it burned, you know, getting the knife out. That's not magic. So our job, very much so, is to make that interesting. A good way to do that is with jokes. And I think that's, again, why stock lines come in, because those are just easy. They don't take practice to do a stock line. You just have to parrot it really quickly. And then, but you also, yeah, streamline stuff, right? What can you cut out of your procedure to make it as short as possible without sacrificing clarity? and using as much seasoning and spice as possible to make as much of the procedure be as funny as possible and interesting. If you can't be funny, at least be interesting.
If you're constantly trying to update your act and add new material and everything, you said that you try to have something new every year and a half. So are you getting rid of other things just for fear that you might be letting stock lines slip in, or why not keep the same act?
I perform. I have a residency at a theater in San Francisco, and so that's the act I normally replace. And that's because I have people that come back, and I discovered that even if I would keep largely the same structure. So like my base act was like, I'd do a bottle production, a tossed out deck, there'd be some stuff in the middle, and then it'd end with bullet catch. And that was like the base structure. And I would change out those middle segments, like there were, you know, four other tricks in the show. And those would change out. But then I'd have people come back a year later and they'd be like, oh, it's the same show. And it's because that structure was the same.
Oh,
right. It's
like, okay,
it was very, it didn't matter that these little things in the middle changed. The structure was the same. So I was like, I need to change the structure every year. Not every year. I think comedians do a year. I think magic, a year and a half, too, is a little bit more realistic because we have to, you know, there's more stuff we've got to kind of rehearse and practice and stuff,
right,
than just trying out words.
Are you adding new tricks, though, from time to time? I mean, every year and a half,
yeah,
kind of it's.
Oh, yeah. So like I did my grand act. I did a whole show that was actually set at like a birthday party. So it was like a kid's birthday party, but like it's me doing bullet catch and cigarette magic and stuff. And it was all about like, yeah, it was like a big contrast. It's also like a close up room. So it was like adjusting to this venue that I was already in. And that was interesting. And the only things I kept from the old act was bullet catch. And I moved that again up to the top, and then everything else would new finale. Everything else was different. And then this past year, I wrote a new one, which brought back some other old classic material, but kind of re-envisioned some of it. Bullet catch is still there just because it's such a strong thing, but it's really, really early on. And it had a whole new finale, a whole different structure, and stuff. And those things show. My corporate act still uses a lot of my original show because that I think just works the best. But I'm constantly recycling bits and pieces back in four segments to, especially for scaffolding new ideas and new tricks, right? Like I can, in the book, I talk about this inspector sequence, which is how I have, the card shuffled for my tossed out deck. I use that to introduce the bottle for coin and bottle when I'm just first debuting coin and bottle. I use it to toss out the rope if I need that, or a book test, right? You can always reuse that, that material.
Right, right.
And cycle things back.
So what is the last section of that? You're saying there's three parts in there, so the third part would be what in the book?
The third part is about the lab, which is now we move into creating new material. So I talk about how do you take the base patter of a trick and what do you keep from that? How do you disinfect the patter, the supplied patter for a brand new trick and do it without stock lines? What are the I give you like the first three jokes that I write for every new routine. And I give you, there's some more stuff too. I talk about the four jokes that I write for every single gig that I do, custom topical material that I write for every gig. And then the two jokes that I'm always writing, which are essentially, you know, a joke to fix, a joke to build upon what is working, whether or not that's a particular joke or a particular, moment of magic. And then a joke to fix something that isn't working as well as expected. A lot of that for me always comes down to dead time, right? When I first started doing linking finger rings, I did not anticipate how long it takes to go around and get three rings from people.
Yes.
And
let me give you a quick tip on, by the way, that you don't want to do that in a retirement home where people have arthritic fingers. I learned that the hard way once, and it took me probably 5 minutes, which seemed like 15, to try to get rings off of men's fingers in particular, or women as well, because they just couldn't get them over their knuckles, and it took forever, and I only got like one after 5 minutes, and I was like, okay, never mind, let's go into something else. And I'd never done it for, you know, an older group since then. Just small tip.
I don't know if this is true. Was the Himba ring developed for people with arthritis?
I
heard that, but I don't have a source on it.
I would imagine so. It makes sense as to how that you can get them on and off that way easier.
That's where I thought you were going, is like they already had the – they're like, that's what my ring is like.
No.
Talk about like A stooge. Is that a method where you just go to somebody who looks like they have arthritis and borrow their ring so you get it? You borrow your hammer ring for every day?
That would be good. Yeah, it's like it'd be no big deal for them. It's like, I get that.
Yeah. Doesn't matter.
So you're recording each of your shows, I assume, then even after you have, you know, when you're going through the process of inputting your new material, then you're recording them again and you're listening to the audience's reaction to make sure that those are working, but you don't throw them out immediately. I'm assuming that you continue to work those because it may not work for one group or vice versa for the
other. I think three strikes is a good rule.
Okay.
Three strikes.
Good to know.
on a particular line. And again, shifting around different punchlines, different setups, phrases on things can change things. Also, placement in a show can be different. I mean, if it doesn't work after three tries, it's time to abandon it. You got to be really comfortable with killing your babies and just being like, it doesn't quite work.
Would you recommend
throwing it away?
Would you recommend also going to improv classes? Or did you ever do that?
I have done it. In high school, I did a ton of theater. So, I did a lot of musical theater, I've done some improv stuff lately. With just groups and stuff like that. Improv is an interesting thing that might be useful for like just how to interact with people and keep the ball rolling. I don't know if it's necessarily a great thing to be funny particularly. I think for me, it's always about preparation and being as prepared as possible if you want to be funny. And improv is being honest, which is very much like what's in vogue right now, just saying the honest thing, what would I honestly say right now, I think can get laughs. But I don't like, I think magicians need to prepare more and not, you know, riff as much. So many comedy magic is about like, oh, I'm just going to mine the audience member for feedback and ask them questions and react silly to whatever they do. And that's very easy. Crowd work is very, very easy to do. And I think it's an interesting tool, but I don't particularly like it. I'd rather hear what you as the performer actually have to say and the ideas that you have rather than interview this person from Alabama that I've never known and is not that interesting. You know, that's what I would push for is really learn to write. That's what the book's about. It's learning to write and not having to improv. Because if you do improv, then you're going to fall more into generic tropes. Most of the, you know, Wayne Brady, all that stuff is like most of the jokes that they make are not particularly insightful. I buy into this is happening now and that's what's interesting, but it's usually very obvious jokes.
What's the hardest part of writing new material?
I think it's very much sitting down to do it. I've been doing a lot more of it now that I've been quarantined. I really have been sticking to like getting up in the morning and trying to write like 10 new jokes for the day, just adjusting things. Like I've got a list of Zoom jokes to make for web things. Again, anticipating what's going to happen when it freezes, right? What's going to happen when I have trouble getting in or someone else is late? How can I adapt this material to those situations? And also for me, it is my writing technique is very like functional. It's building of like this line does this thing and building up and it gets a laugh and trying to be a little bit more true and honest to myself of like, okay, but what are the ideas that I really, really do want to express? And how can I make that into a joke is something that that's kind of the precipice I'm really starting to like push myself over and really try to get into. Again, reading the Judy Carter book, which is very much about that of like, write down things that you care about and then let's find jokes for that. Mm-hmm. My book doesn't do that. My book is about adjusting the functional things in your show to make sure that you're not doing stock lines. But that's where I would like to push myself now to how can I really reflect who I am as a person, what I care about. And I have bits in my show that do that, and I love them. They're my favorite things, but I want more of it.
Right. Well, I tell you, as we start to wrap up over there, for people who would want to get your book, is it available online or is it a hard copy edition?
It is available on Amazon. It is on Kindle and there's paperback as well. If you go to Amazon and type in Out of Stock Ryan Kane, that is Kane with a K, K-A-N-E, you can get it through Amazon right there. There's also, you can go to my website, ryankanemagic.com/the-book. There's a page there that will lead there, and I'm sure you can probably put this in the show notes as well, I would assume, a link to those. And it's people have been saying really nice things about this. This is my debut book. You know, I'm very underground in magic. I just work and do shows and stuff, and so it's been very nice to have people say, like, wow, no, this book's really good.
It's good to hear from a worker, certainly, who is finally sharing some ideas from your professional School of Hard Knocks, basically.
Yeah, and I wanted it to be something that was true to me. That's like, yeah, you know what? I'm not the finest thing in the world, but like this is a story I did live. Like I went from, you know, these are the balls in Roman I stuff to a show that has some pretty good jokes in it that are true to myself, and I'm actually very proud of it. And I'd be like, yeah, no, look, this is cool. I give examples in the book, and I also write with the reader in the book. I'm like, here, I'm gonna write 10 jokes with you so you can see how bad my ideas are, some of them, and then, but look, this is good and here's how I'd polish it and stuff. And I give examples of stuff in the show, but I don't want people to read the book and just steal jokes out of it. So like I'm not
The whole idea is not to take the jokes that you've been coming up with, but to use these as kind of a ramp, I guess, kind of to an off ramp. So that way they can kind of create their own from that standpoint.
By the end of it, you should be able to generate ideas faster, better than ever before. You'll be able to iterate on those ideas better with a feedback loop of being able to analyze what's going on and identify things in the show. By the end of this, you can use the same process to go back, you know, get rid of all the pronouns in your show or notice all the dead time in your show. Like you can do the same process to replace whatever. Look, I want to introduce a new theme to my show, and I just want to go through and find locations where that might happen, right? And you can do this for anything. And I think stock lines is just the first step in. That's an issue I think a lot of magicians have, and one that they would like to get, that they would like to remedy. And this teaches it, and it's a quick read. It's kind of a problem. Like the book tells you to set the text aside and read, but me being me, I write the book, so you can't ever really put it down. Like it just keeps flowing because I'm a street performer. It's like, I don't want you walking away.
That's funny. Well, as we do close, the name of the podcast is called The Magic Word. And I always like to know what my guest philosophy of life, what is it you live by? What is your magic word or phrase or sentence?
Ooh, that is good.
What's important to you?
What is important to me? Wow. I really like the phrase, you know, don't practice till you get it right. Practice till you can't get it wrong. Prepare. I don't know whose quote that is.
It's yours now.
It's not mine now. I will cite. That's the other thing too, is like taking accountability to it. Like I try to cite it. Like this isn't my idea, but I heard this and I like it. You know? And if I ever do say a line in my show still, but I mean, it still happens, right? It's like nervous or something like that. And something does come out. I usually do take a moment to like credit, like that wasn't mine, you know, like, and I credit if I can. I've said a couple things where like, for some reason I say, the line, this is the international sign for give me when I hold things, which is a Max Maven line that I've seen him use. And, for some reason I can't get that out of my head sometimes, and it will still come out, and I'm always like, he's like, I owe Max Maven a quarter every time I say the joke. So Max, I'll send you a check. Whenever.
And it's for what? Forgive me? Oh, forgive me.
No, what? For give me. This that's the international sign for give me.
Oh, gotcha.
He goes like this, like holding. I don't do that stuff. I just hold my hand out.
All right. Well, that's good. I appreciate that. And that's food for thought then as well. So great, Ryan. Thanks very much. Appreciate being my guest then today, and kind of learned a lot. And that hopefully people will be going out and reevaluating their own shows and rewriting them and having some more creative people. Because I've always said that, you know, you're not really going to be successful unless that you are you. If you are just copying someone else's lines, then you're just, you know, Mac King, or you're somebody else. You're really not yourself. You're Michael Finney, whoever that's you're copying. You know, it's like, yeah, you know, you like these guys, but as far as, you know, getting to the next level, if you want to be at the you know, your A game, you can only be you. And so you need to identify who you are. I don't think there's anything wrong in starting, you know, with a few things, you know, but then you need to grow.
I think if you're just getting into magic, there's so much you need to learn. Do invisible deck, do the normal lines, you know, if you're just learning. And then once you understand, oh, this is what a good magic trick looks and feels like, then you got to get him rid of. And if that's the thing right now, is like, if you've been doing magic for 10 years, you're no longer a beginner, right? If you've performed at the same annual event 3 years in a row, you're no longer a beginner. If booking your act involves a W-9 or a tax form, you're no longer a beginner, right?
That's like, right.
It's time to leave this behind. It's time to start learning how to write new jokes and be more of you.
Be more of you. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. Thank you very much, Ryan. I do appreciate your time over here and sharing that with us. And I recommend that people go take a look at what you have offered over there, Out of Stock.
Out of stock. Thank you so much, Scott.
You bet. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Ryan Kane. This is Scotty L. Well, there you have it. That was a pretty educational and insightful little discussion, almost like a mini lecture with some ideas. And I don't have a copy of his book. I have not read it. But from what he has explained, it sounds like that's something that would be great for all of us to have as required reading on our bookshelves, and not just in our bookshelves, but perhaps something you carry around your backpack or your briefcase so that you can refer to it from time to time and remind you to make sure that you get rid of those stock lines and start putting in something new and original that's actually you. Well, thanks again, Ryan, for sharing that with us, and that was great. And just a couple of things about that, by the way. When you're going to be ordering a copy on Amazon, let me suggest if you would please help the Magic Word Podcast by just using us as your Amazon affiliate. In other words, if you go to themagicwordpodcast.com, at the bottom of the page, just scroll all the way to the bottom, there will be a link, or actually a little banner that says Amazon affiliate. Click on this, and when you do, then that will magically take you to your Amazon account page, and there you can order whatever you want to order, and we get a little bit of compensation back through their affiliate program. It's no additional charge to you, and so any and everything that you buy through Amazon through this affiliate link will help us. So your aid will be appreciated if you can just do that one little extra thing whenever you're going to be buying not just his book, but anything else through Amazon. Also, be sure to subscribe to our pod letter. And if you just go, when you go to the website, it'll pop up. Well, another great episode we had here this week. And thank you guys again very much for tuning in and listening this week. We've got some more great conversations coming up in future weeks. And also, we've been having some fun on video of late with our Magic and Martini Thursday nights that have been live on our Facebook page for the Magic Word. So if you haven't liked the Magic Word Facebook page, be sure and do that, and you can tune in live as we start to kind of play with something a little bit new right now. I'm not sure if it's going to continue for a long time, but we're having some fun and some great guests. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to not just practice until you get it right, but practice until you can't do it wrong. This is Scotty out.